Reconnecting with our moral values to make a better America.
But if you roll back a few years, if you said, gee, I feel bad about what's happening to people, you would get scorned. You would be labeled, as I have been many times, a bleeding heart liberal. Yeah, I am a bleeding heart. I think it's wrong to just trash people's lives, especially in a country as rich as ours. So I think the economic reforms require us to reconnect with our moral values. Just say, are people treated fairly in this country?
That's William Grider. We replay our 2009 interview with him about his book, Come Home, America. Grider passed away on Christmas Day, 2019. We also hear from my 2011 interview with Harold Bloom, who also passed away in 2019. Then, an interview I did with Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary in 2017 at an event honoring the Reverend Dr. William Barber. And we hear from Barber as well, talking about his Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. That's all on the menu today, this first episode of 2020. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rihanna. William Grider died last week. He was national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of numerous books. Capitalism and Democracy and How They're Often in Conflict was the subject of much of Grider's work. In 2009, I interviewed him for Sea Change Radio, a radio program I co-founded and co-hosted until Alex Wise became the host and producer. It's still on the air. The occasion was the publication of Grider's book, Come Home, America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. It was published soon after Wall Street's crash in 2008 and the start of the Great Recession. But it's as relevant today as it was then, prefiguring the growing questions of capitalism as an economic system that can provide for all or even preserve democracy. I spoke with William Grider at the height of the AIG scandal. I started out by asking him what lessons he drew from the scandal and their relevance to his book.
They are very relevant to the book I've written because, as you know, the central theme of my book is the distance, the divide between governing elites, not just in Washington, but in private enterprise, Wall Street, etc., and the American people. And this is not a new condition, but it's reached a dangerous stage because now we're in this financial economic crisis, and we're seeing it play out almost every day. The AIG scandal doesn't feel like a scandal to people in Wall Street and to many people in Washington. This is a contract. You have to pay the contract. These people did their work, so we can't do anything about it. Meanwhile, the taxpayers have put up, what, $180 billion to keep this zombie corporation alive? The explosion of anger I find quite thrilling, frankly, because people are watching what's happening to their money, and they're enraged, rightly so. And a lot of the people in Washington, not all of them, have been clueless and way behind the curve. So I think we'll see Congress frantically trying to do something, and I hope we see the president and the White House, not to mention the Treasury Department, change course and begin to realize that they have to take care of the people in this crisis. And if that means tearing up some contracts for the guys in suits, so be it.
And as you say, this is very relevant to your book, Come Home, America. You call the U.S., using somebody else I think coined the term, you call the U.S. a plutonomy in which income inequality is really built in. And it does seem the American people are getting the idea that this recovery is being taken out of their hides. But you say this has been happening for a long time. So
yeah.
Walk this through with us and tell us about the role of the Federal Reserve in doing this.
That phrase, incidentally, it comes from the International Study Group at Citigroup. And they were the economists who wrote the paper, which I'm citing, were practically chortling at this situation where the income has been so maldistributed over the last 25, 30 years in America that it's really the rich people who do the consuming. and they documented this, that there's so much surplus at the top that they can more or less keep the economy afloat. And that was the logic behind Bush's tax cuts. We'll give the money back to the rich folks, and they'll spend it and keep us going.
But that doesn't really happen, does it?
I mean, well, it happened in a moderate way, but, of course, what it left out is that in the broad ranks of working people, across the middle class and especially below, people's incomes have been either stagnant or falling for many years, going back to the 1970s. They've essentially flat for industrial workers. And so what's happened to our economy has been weakened in many ways, but the central problem is that people aren't making enough money to buy the stuff we make. And that opens the door for cheaper exports from Asia. You know, the Walmart formula for how we keep America going. And that was developed, this is a bipartisan complaint, I should add. The Democrats like to blame it on George Bush and the Republicans, but in fact, the Democrats cooperated and colluded in this shift for many, many years, including the deregulation of the financial system. So over time, it eroded the capacity of Americans, first to keep up with the mortgage, etc., but also to provide the aggregate demand that keeps the economy going. Now we're at the reckoning, I think, where that system, for lots of reasons, is in collapse. And the good news is that we now have an opportunity to rebuild our society and the economic system in some profound ways. That's what I'm hoping for.
And in order to understand what to do, we have to go back to some of that history. I found your section on the role of the Federal Reserve absolutely fascinating. You wrote a book earlier about the Federal Reserve,
yeah.
Secrets of the Temple. Explain the role of the Fed and who it's working for.
Well, the Federal Reserve was created literally 100 years ago, 1913, out of a series of profound financial panics and crises. Even the bankers in Wall Street finally acknowledged that the country needed a central bank to regulate money and credit and serve ideally as a balance wheel between the forces of recession and boom and between labor and capital. Essentially, what they were doing politically was taking those subjects out of politics and cloistering them in this mysterious organization called a central bank and giving it the technocratic ability to manage things. And it worked in a sense because people did lose sight of those issues. In the 19th century, Americans, especially farmers, understood monetary policy and credit because they lived by it. Now, most Americans are quite ignorant. So my chapter is going to be shocking for a lot of readers because I make the argument that's now confirmed almost every day that the Federal Reserve was a central culprit in causing this catastrophe. They did that by essentially abandoning the role of balance wheel and tipping hard in one direction, capital, and at the same time injuring labor, suppressing wages through by slow growth and so forth and so on. This is a long, complicated story of how this happened, but the Fed actually became a cheerleader, and I mean Alan Greenspan's Fed, for the explosion of credit and debt. And the bubbles, which are now collapsed around us and created such disastrous consequences.
You talk about how, you know, Greenspan, of course, we understand he was the great deregulator. And in that sense, that certainly led up, as many people do see, to the current crisis we have. But you talk about Paul Volcker, who was a regulator.
Mm-hmm.
But the regulation there, as you just said before, was really one-sided. So could you maybe walk us through how that worked?
The most meaningful event in this story was the beginning of financial deregulation, which did not occur under Ronald Reagan, as many people believe. It was done by Democrats in 1980, Democratic president, Democratic Congress, and they repealed the long-standing limits set on various interest rates for different kinds of financial instruments, and they repealed the federal law against usury. Usury is an ancient biblical principle that prevents people with wealth from exploiting usuriously people who were borrowers. And if you look at our society today, we now have interest rates, typical, common, nothing shocking about them, 20-30% on credit cards. That's usury. If you go to poorer neighborhoods, you're familiar with payday loan windows, these little bucket shops. People can't get through the month with on their paychecks, so they borrow at usurious interest rates on their next paycheck. It permeates American economic life now. The subprime mortgages are another example because they're rigged in a way that guarantees the borrower is going to fail. So not right away, but 2-3 years from now, they are going to lose their home. The reason the Federal Reserve went along with this, in fact, Volcker supported the legislation, was that they were getting, first of all, enormous pressure from their principal constituency, which is the Wall Street finance and banking, but also they wanted to be the dominant force in determining government's management of the economy. And they succeeded in that, as we know. I mean, the Fed was obscure 30, 40 years ago, and sophisticated people understood it and followed its actions, but most Americans had never heard of it. When I started reporting in the early 1980s to do my book on the Fed, Secrets of the Temple, I typically would meet presumably really smart people here in Washington who would ask me, what is the Federal Reserve? And some of them thought it was where we stored the gold at Fort Knox. Others thought it was just a printing press where they printed money. And this is the core, absolutely the core of U.S. capitalism, and smart people didn't know what it was. Now, we've come a long way, and when we think of the present crisis, this is educating people in a very brutal way. And one of the lessons it's teaching is who has power and who doesn't. I mean, what people have seen in the last 9 months is quite shocking. Democrats, as well as Republicans, rushes to rescue the financial firms and banks that caused the crisis. And people said, wait a minute, how does that work? Next, people learned that actually the government has plenty of money to spend if the right people demand it.
Well, here's the question exactly, because I guess what I'm hearing you saying is, I mean, we can remember that, you know, interest rates have been very, very cheap for the prime interest rate, you know, for the borrowing of capital for people who have a lot of capital. And at the same time, we have these usurious interest rates you've been talking, that you talked about when it comes to credit cards or subprime mortgages, when it's the kind of money that the average consumer borrows. The Fed has bailed out the big banks who caused this problem. How could they have done it better?
I had a piece in The Nation magazine last week called Fixing the Fed, and I went through this story of how the Federal Reserve played a very heavy hand in creating the catastrophe. It literally has lost control of the credit system. Deregulation did that in some ways because it basically repealed or weakened the old prudential rules that treated commercial banks very differently from financial houses, and it allowed the banks to collaborate with those non-bank financial firms, and that's what produced all this funny money leverage and the derivatives and the mortgage securities and on and on and on. And again, I emphasize, a lot of this was done by Democrats, that supposedly the party of the working class. And they made their own deal with the devil in getting very close to Wall Street finance, and that sector became a major contributor to the Democratic Party. Now we're in a stage where both parties are in the awkward position of having to fix what they caused. Now, they don't admit that with any decency or clarity, much less apologize for it. So I'm nervous that the reform efforts will again be skewed in favor of those interests, the Wall Street Club. that's why I get excited when I see people all over the country, regardless of party or income or class or anything else, just reacting with horror at what's happening. I think that's good because I think it will at least drive the politicians to be a little more cautious about doing deals for their old friends.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're listening to an interview I did in 2009 with William Grider, who passed away last week. Now, you talked about some of the ways in which Wall Street has enforced inequality. One of the things people don't really talk about a lot is how this works with wages, how it suppresses wages. I found it very interesting you have an example of Paul Volcker carrying around in his pocket a card showing the latest contracts being signed by big unions. So how does that work with the interest rates to suppress wages?
The mechanism is basically goes like this. The Fed has the ability, and this is not illegitimate, this is its role, to serve as a sort of a balance wheel, a moderating force on both the upside and the downside. Part of that is to prevent inflation from getting out of control, but it's also intended to allow the economy to produce at a high level and therefore get lower unemployment. If it sees the economy growing too rapidly and signs of inflation developing, it will raise interest rates, which in effect raises the price of everything we buy that's connected to borrowed money. It squeezes down the supply of credit, and therefore the economy moderates or slows down. If it does that severely, as it sometimes has, it induces a recession. Sometimes intentionally, sometimes by accident, but it has that kind of power. On the other side, when the economy is sinking into recession, it cuts interest rates, and that stimulates demand. That's the mechanism. The way it uses it in the last 25 years, starting with Volcker, is holding interest rates higher than they need to be in order to suppress growth and keep unemployment higher than it ought to be. And that makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for working people, especially in unions, to bargain for higher wages. Paul Volcker carried around in his card when politicians, including Republicans, were pleading with him to cut interest rates in the recession of 1982 so the economy could get started again. And he'd pull out this card which said, well, the Teamsters got this in their last contract, and UAW got this, and the steelworkers got that. Well, labor's still getting too much, and I'm going to have to hold until their wages start coming down faster. This is our government we're talking about here. This is not private opinion. That essentially broke the wage levels of organized labor and lots of other workers as well, and they've been flat ever since. And now globalization played a hand in that and helped him do that because the companies were meanwhile moving those good high-wage jobs offshore. And together, that's why working people especially have essentially had stagnant incomes for the last 25, 30 years. Now, people know this. You can go into any corner of America and talk to people. They may not have the dates precisely, but they understand what's happened to them. And they react as rational human beings by doing two things. First, they work more. And you can see this in families all over. Either the spouse went to work for the first time, or both husband and wife took on extra jobs. And so you literally find, and not to mention kids, the teenagers, you literally find families with not just one job or two jobs, but maybe four or five jobs. Now, those tend to be crummy part-time jobs, but what choice do people have? The other choice is they borrow the money. And that's what people have been doing now in rather dangerous proportions for the last 20 years plus. They get into debt on a credit card, but they also borrow more against their house. They have equity in their home because they've been paying a mortgage for many years. So they take an equity line, and they literally live off the equity line.
In 2009, when I spoke with him, Grider expressed optimism about the U.S., despite the hard times of the Great Recession. I didn't get a chance to talk with him about Occupy Wall Street or Bernie Sanders' political revolution, but in this interview, Grider seems prescient about those developments.
I think if people will engage and face the facts, we can change this country in very positive ways. In fact, ways that most people, I think, would support if they understood the options are available. Well, unfortunately, as that happens, we're going to go through a really hard passage, and I think we're in the beginnings of it now.
So let's get to some of your prescriptions for the patient on the table here. You propose six large initiatives, and let's take the first. Moral principle is at the top of the list.
Yeah. You know, everybody knows, almost everybody, that one of the damages to America has been the erosion of moral values in the last generation. And I'm not talking right versus left. I'm talking about simple principles of integrity and honesty and fair dealing and, above all, human sympathy. And this is changing now. But if you reel back a few years, if you said, gee, I feel bad about what's happening to people, you would get scorned. You would be labeled, as I have been many times, a bleeding heart liberal. Yeah, I am a bleeding heart. I think it's wrong to just trash people's lives, especially in a country as rich as ours. So I think the economic reforms require us to reconnect with our moral values. Just say, are people treated fairly in this country? I mean, we were talking about usury and predatory lending. To me, one of the things the Congress could do, and this president, if they chose, is just say, you know what, usury is wrong. We know it's wrong. We can't get there instantly, but we're going to begin a process that rebalances lending and borrowing to develop the kind of fairness that everybody knows ought to be in the system. Now, that drives the bankers crazy, and it drives some of the financial guys crazy. But you could get an overwhelming majority of Americans to say yes to that without much work, I think. And then you go into the other area that I feel strongly about and I've seen a lot of, is people at work. And work is a really central part of our lives. And how are people regarded and treated at work? And we know the story of how organized labor has been hammered and the working poor and part-time workers and so forth and so on. But the truth is, if you go into the middle of very large corporations, you will find the same hurt and anger in their terms. And I mean people with pretty good incomes know that they are powerless to talk back to their superiors, but also to help shape their own work and environment.
Grider told me making the economy more democratic will take a new national conversation.
It matters that people start in their own experience. What do they know? What do they think? What if they were king for a day, what would they wish to change in our society? Because out of those discussions, little by little to be sure, but across a very broad front, then Americans are all talking about the same subject, and they're not writing legislation, not yet anyway. But that's political power. I just give you one vivid example that is at the heart of my optimism, frankly. The civil rights movement. I was a young reporter. I didn't cover a few, but not many of the great big dramatic events that people wrote about. But I went into small towns, usually in crisis when they were in a racial conflict that was quite intense, even violent. And I saw the courage of black people across the South, among other places, deciding to do this for themselves, and was in awe of those people, because you know, in a small town, when you stick your head up and object to the regular order, you're taking a real risk. I mean, you can lose your life if you do it too bluntly. And out of that came the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement never won an election, especially in the South, and yet it changed the country. I just want to leave that in people's heads, that it will take a commitment and confidence in ourselves to accomplish that in these circumstances.
Well, Bill Greider, thanks so much for talking with us here. Your book is Come Home America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
William Greider. I spoke with him in 2009 about his book, Come Home America. Greider was national affairs correspondent for The Nation. In addition to Come Home America, he was the author of numerous other books, including Fortress America, One World, Ready or Not, and The Soul of Capitalism. He died on Christmas Day. Harold Bloom passed away in October 2019. He was called the most notorious literary critic in America because he elevated the Western literary canon over others, arguing for the superiority of Shakespeare, Chaucer, and Kafka, white men all. He wasn't a progressive, and he scorned multiculturalism, and his treatment of women also wasn't so great. But he gave me an interesting interview back in 2011 when I visited him to talk about his anthology of last poems by diverse poets and his commentary on them. It's called Till I End My Song.
By last poems, I sometimes mean in this volume, perhaps more often than not, the very last poem that they wrote, like Michael Drayton's beautiful poem to the lady he had loved, but only in a companionate or friendly fashion all his life. In his last poem, the poem written the night before he dies, or a poem that seems to operate like a last poem. The Tempest is not Shakespeare's last play, but Prospero's extraordinary climactic speech. Pragmatically, is something close to Shakespeare's last poem. Or finally, a poem that a particular poet saw as the climax or fulfillment of their poetic career in relation to the inevitability of an impending death. So those are three different senses, but they are related. A literal last poem intended as a last poem, I would take, as I've mentioned already, Michael Drayton, a good friend of Shakespeare, the lovely poem beginning so well, I love thee. I write a brief commentary to introduce each of these poems. And he himself writes, I won't read the whole poem because it is 21 lines. And he writes, so these verses were made by Michael Drayton, Esquire, Poet Laureate, the night before he died. And it opens beautifully. It's addressed to this lady he had been brought up with, Anne Goodair, Lady Rainsford. He had been a page in the service of Sir Henry Goodair, a friend of Sir Philip Sidney. Goodair's daughter Anne and Drayton, as I write, were childhood friends, but their mutual love was socially impossible since he was a commoner and she was a high noblewoman, and they sanely settled for a perpetual friendship. And he commemorates that since she's going to survive him. And he's very ill, and he knows he's dying, and so beautifully written, so well I love thee, as without thee I love nothing. If I might choose, I'd rather die than be one day debarred thy company. Since beasts and plants do grow and live and move, beasts are those men that such a life approve. He only lives that deadly is in love, meaning that is certainly and fully in love. And then he ends the poem very beautifully. So all my thoughts are pieces but of you, which put together makes a glass so true, as I therein no other's face but yours can view. I found that quite exquisite and a beautiful tribute to the lady and a wonderful dying word on his part. Then I thought, since there are 56 poets, more or less, of the modern period from Thomas Hardy to the present, of them, about 25 were people I knew personally, 7 or 8 of them very close friends indeed. And one of them was certainly a wonderful poet and wonderful human being, wonderful novelist also, Robert Penn Warren. and I want to find his poem. Here it is, Heart of Autumn. Warren was 25 years older than I was, but we became close friends from January 1973 until his death 16 years later in 1989. And he wrote this extraordinary poem, Heart of Autumn, which I always thought was the culmination of his work. I once told him that if I had to choose a single poem by him as his last poem, in the sense that it speaks his total word with permanent distinction, I would choose Heart of Autumn. And I say here, I think Red Warren would have wished me to do so. Rather reluctantly, Red told me once that the poem might have been his best. And it's an extraordinary poem. I can't bear not to read all of it or chant all of it. By the way, let's see. Red, I think, must have been in his 70s when he wrote this poem. Heart of Autumn. Wind finds the northwest gap. Fall comes. Today, under gray cloud scud and over gray, wind flicker a forest in perfect formation. Wild geese head for a land of warm water. The boom, the lead pellets. Some crumple in air, fall. Some stagger, recover control. Then take the last glide for a far glint of water. None know what has happened. Now today, watching how tirelessly, V upon V, arrows the season's logic, do I know my own story? At least they know when the hour comes for the great wing beat. Sky strider, star strider, they rise, and the imperial utterance which cries out for distance quivers in the wheeling sky. That much they know, and in their nature know the path of pathlessness, with all the joy of destiny fulfilling its own name. I have known time and distance, but not why I am here. Path of logic, path of folly, all the same. And I stand, my face lifted now skyward, hearing the high beat, my arms outstretched in the tingling process of transformation, and soon tough legs with folded feet trail in the sounding vacuum of passage, and my heart is impacted with a fierce impulse to unwordable utterance toward sunset at a great height. I find that marvelous. I find that Red Warren really assimilating himself to those wild geese and to their flight, which becomes an image of both the limitations and the strength of his own poetic imagination. And then, but then the third sense, the sense of a last poem, really as a way of coming to terms with all of life. And a very close friend, A.R. Ammons, Archie Ammons, who died in 2001 when he was 75, remarkable poet. He wrote a poem in 1996, 5 years before his death. And it seems to me truly his last poem, as I say here, because it's miraculous in its control of a universal poignance. I won't read all of it aloud, but I want to read the very opening and the close. It's called In View of the Fact. The people of my time are passing away. My wife is baking for a funeral. A 60-year-old who died suddenly when the phone rings. And it's Ruth we care so much about in intensive care. It was once weddings that came so thick and fast, and then first babies, such a hullabaloo. Now it's this, that, and the other, and somebody else gone or on the brink. Well, we never thought we would live forever, although we did. And now it looks like we won't. And then he goes on talking about how these things work out for us. And he suddenly says very powerfully, at the same time we are getting used to so many leaving, we are hanging on with a grip to the ones left. We are not giving up on the congestive heart failures or brain tumors, on the nice old men left in empty houses, or on the widows who decide to travel a lot. We think the sun may shine someday when we'll drink wine together and think of what used to be. Until we die, we will remember every single thing, recall every word, love every loss. Then we will, as we must, leave it to others to love. Love that can grow brighter and deeper to the very end, gaining strength and getting more precious all the way. I find that, of course, almost unbearably moving because I have been missing him now for 9 years. But, you know, I'm making this anthology sound too somber, and I don't think it is somber. I think it is affirmative. I think, as Wallace Stevens greatly remarked, poetry is one of the enlargements of life.
That was Harold Bloom, one of the last of the great literary critics of the 20th century. His wonderful collection of last poems is Till I End My Song. Harold Bloom talking with me in 2011 about his anthology, Till I End My Song. After the break, we hear from Peter Yarrow and the Reverend William Barber. Don't touch that dial. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. For this New Year's, I put my hand into the box of previously recorded interviews that didn't make it onto Writer's Voice because they were produced for other radio programs. In 2018, I went to an event where the Reverend Dr. William Barber spoke about his Poor People's Campaign and a national call for moral revival. The great folk singer Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary was there to perform as well. As we were waiting for the event to begin, I sat down with Peter Yarrow to ask him about the role of music in progressive movements. He started out by reminiscing about performing at the 50th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March, a march he had been on himself.
I was the only speaker that day. I was the only singer that day who had been to the original one, singing at the original one, and John Lewis was the only speaker who had been. And when he was there, he said, the civil rights movement without music would have been a bird without wings.
The civil rights movement without music would have been a bird without wings. That's very inspiring. And you were part of Peter, Paul, and Mary. Talk a little bit about when you formed that troupe, how that interacted with your politics. How was the message and your music interwoven?
Well, Mary was actually in a group called the Song Swappers that was organized by Pete Seeger as a teenager. And she adored him, idolized him. So did I. I went to my first hootenanny at the Brick Church where Brownie and Sonny were playing and Pete was also playing. And so Mary and I were steeped in a left-wing perspective from our earliest years. Her parents were journalists, and there was a point at which apparently Paul Robeson was in their home and he sang some lullabies to her. Mm. So we came by this before we knew each other. We were both there in 1955 at the Weavers at Carnegie Hall, that when Harold Leventhal produced that concert that brought them back from the blacklist into Carnegie Hall, which was a seminal moment for for us and other folks. But I didn't meet her then. I didn't meet her until 1960. So Noel, Paul Stuckey, was from the Midwest, basically an apolitical background, not a folk singer. He had a rock and roll band, and he was into jazz, and he was into pop music, but he was a great heart, an extraordinary comedian, played a terrific guitar, and when the three of us sang together, it was magic. And it was magic the first time, and we sang Mary Had a Little Lamb. But the direction of the group was what Mary called, she said, we are Seeger's Raiders. And that's because Pete was the one who blazed the path whereby singers would unite their hearts with the songs in such a way that the intention, whether it was singing The Water is Wide or We Shall Not Be Moved, was about creating a society of caring, loving, and a heartfelt commitment to the things that we'd believed in most. So from the beginning, this was not, for me, an exercise in singing songs and entertainment, nor was it for Mary. It was only about, not only, it was primarily about creating community in the sense that I hope we will create a little community today. Because when this happens, and you will see this or you will feel it, something allows people to open their hearts and to care in a certain way. And in an era when in which we are being abused by the constant confusion of messages that are so frequently intended to shatter everything that we have built ethically, morally, and in terms of the law, you know, this is needed. Reverend Barber will bring people together in a particular way that is thrilling. And his honesty and his emotional and spiritual transparency is extraordinary. But what I do actually is a group participation, which you know from Pete Seeger, when everybody's singing, it's a magical thing.
Well, Peter Yarrow, Peter, Paul, and Mary made it into the mainstream, and yet you came from a left-wing perspective that wasn't mainstream at the time. Do you feel that you were able to, kind of under the guise of being popular folk singers, be able to bring a kind of message to America, as it were, sub rosa, that people could then learn from?
It wasn't necessary to be sub rosa at that point. The world was ready to explode with an effort to shed the conventions and the social and political lies, whether it would be the subjugation of the blacks according to the legacy of slavery that still remained, whether it was the oppression of women, whether it was the issues surrounding our place as a nation in terms of ultimately what segued the civil rights movement into the anti-Vietnam War movement. It was a time of discovery of the way we could talk to each other as men and women, the way we could not rely on the trappings of wealth to measure our worth and status. It was a time when, to one degree or another, everybody, we didn't have to be undercover. We were singing Where Have All the Flowers Gone? We were singing Blowing in the Wind. If I Had a Hammer, we sang at the March on Washington in 63. There was no need at that time, because I think that the establishment had not yet identified the power of this kind of gathering of souls together, ordinary people, not powerful people, not elected officials. But that's what we learned from the civil rights movement, and that movement became the mother of the other movements that emerged from it, including the women's movement, the anti-apartheid movement, the climate movement, you know, all of that. What happened was that we realized that as human beings, if we stood together and joined our hearts in a deep commitment, we could move the needle. We could change the path of history. And I think that they were astonished, the establishment, to realize that this was possible. And that's when they began to gird their loins to try and hold that back. The critical moment being 1968, when it turned, when Richard Nixon ran, won the election.
And Martin Luther King was assassinated, as was Bobby Kennedy, so all those had a real impact. So I wanted to ask you finally, Peter Yarrow, that's inspiring, your words about 50 years ago, about the past. What inspires you about this moment?
What inspires me is the capacity that I still feel that people have to emerge from this cloud of despair and reassert their decency when I am in a position to sing to them. So I know that this is, at this point, only skin deep, but if you lie in the gutter long enough, it's, you're not going to smell that pretty. So I'm also involved, I'll tell you what else I'm involved in that's inspiring. I met a group that had just, the leaders of a group called Better Angels that had just been in a small town in Ohio called Lebanon, South Lebanon. And they had brought together 8 Republicans and 8 Democrats. This was a town that went 80% for Donald Trump. And a Dr. Bill Daugherty from the University of Minnesota, who has written books in the area of conflict resolution and marital therapy and et cetera, or marital communications and transactional exchanges, put together a circumstance in which the people, when they came in, were first asked, okay, you are the red, for lack of a better word, red-leaning group, you are the blue-leaning group, you go into separate rooms and you decide what are the 5 most difficult for you, painful characterizations, stereotypical characterizations of you by the others that you feel are entirely wrong and painful, and then say to what degree are those characterizations accurate. So they came back and they each had a representative, and all of a sudden both sides heard the others speaking sense, saying, well, you know, one said, well, they think we're baby killers because we, you know, we support a woman's right to choose. And nobody's for abortion, but everybody is, as I said in the Women's March, I wrote this for Mary, I'm not pro-abortion, I'm pro-choice here today, and I'm protecting the Constitution of the USA. So here we are in this room, and the other side said, well, they call us homophobic. Well, to be honest with you, if we're honest with ourselves, a lot of us are homophobic. But it's not because we hate people. My brother is homosexual, he says. And I love him. But we've been taught this in our religion and other things. So a lot of us have that point of view, you know. So they're all of a sudden they're saying, oh, my God, these are reasonable people. They're looking at themselves. And also, I am calling them things that would be painful for me to be called in certain ways. And all of a sudden, they responded, okay, says Dr. Bill Daugherty, what did you learn? And then we go through 13 hours of exchanges. Now, what I wanted to say, that these are glimmers of hope, but where do I think the hope basically lies? It lies in the fact that at this point, this turn to a totalitarian jungle of bacchanal, Roma's burning, inhumanity, celebration of cruelty, bullying, absence of a value system that honors people's intrinsic worth. That's not that deep. That's my hope. Number one. Number two, the women. That's where it is. The women have emerged. Not like like never before. And the young people. So if we're looking to something else besides us folks here today, who will be part of it, we have to acknowledge and allow the leadership of the kids.
Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul and Mary. Let's hear the trio sing If I Had a Hammer at the 1967 March on Washington.
And now, a group of singers who have come to help express in song what this great meeting is all about. I give you now Peter, Paul, and Mary.
After I spoke with Peter Yarrow, I was able to snatch a few minutes with the Reverend Dr. William Barber at the event where he had come to speak about his Poor People's Campaign, centered on creating a moral revival in America for social justice. I'm so glad to be able to talk with you here today about the Poor People's Campaign. Mm-hmm. Now, you call this a moral
uprising.
A moral uprising.
Moral action. Moral articulation and moral analysis. And what we mean by that is the language we're using for this moment is too puny. It is too limited. When we merely think the debate is left versus right, conservative versus Democrat, those terms bind you up in a certain way. When we talk about dealing with 140 million poor people, low-income people in this country, we shouldn't be talking about that as a Republican-Democrat issue, but a matter of the heart and soul of the nation. That's a moral issue. When we look at 37 million people without health care and 13 million poor children in the wealthiest nation in the world, that we're the only nation of 25 of the wealthiest nations that does not offer health care to its citizens, that's much more deeper than just some puny political issue. It's really an issue about who are we? Who are we in our deepest religious values? Who are we in our deepest moral values? How does that line up with the call of our Constitution to establish justice when we give $2 trillion of tax cuts to the wealthy and the greedy, knowing that we have 73.5% of the poor are women and children, and 43.5% of this country are poor and low-wealth people? Whether or not we clean up the 4 million families that live with lead in their water, they can buy unleaded gas, they can't buy unleaded water. That's bigger than just Republican versus Democrat. spending $600 billion in war, almost two times more than we spent in Vietnam. When we put a combat soldier on the field at about $29,000 a year, but we pay defense contractors $19 million on average, and people are making a killing off of killing, somewhere we have to call people to a moral uprising. When we see Supreme Court seats being stolen and then persons being put on that Supreme Court, that not only would Roe versus Wade, that would hurt poor women the most, but have strange ideas about immigration. Where do these candidates stand on Brown versus Board of Education? Is that settled law for them? Is the voting rights settled law? Is the 14th Amendment settled law? Or are we going to try to undo that primary constitutional piece that says all persons have a right to equal protection under the law? When we still deal with racism the way we deal with it today, I'm not talking about Roseanne Barr's words, but the works of racism, systemic voter suppression that we haven't seen since Jim Crow in more than 23 states that impacted our election long before Russia did anything. These are moral questions, whether it's constitutionally moral, establishment of justice, promoting the common for the general welfare, or our deepest religious traditions that say the first goal of a nation, if it is to be a great nation, is how it cares for the poor, how it cares for the sick, how it cares for the undocumented and the stranger, and how it cares for the least of these.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Bless you. Thank you.
The Reverend Dr. William Barber speaking with me in 2018. Join us next week on Writer's Voice when we talk with master of World War II spy fiction, Alan First, about his new thriller, Under Occupation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.